My name is Dr. Alex Bailey. I'm a school and clinical psychologist. And my both my training and my experience involves both schoolwork and clinical work. The schoolwork is really revolves around working with kids in the school system, both in assessing learning and behavioral issues, and then developing interventions with the teachers and the administration to help these kids. And I've really worked with kids of all ages. In my private practice, I have worked also with kids of all ages, though what I've started to shift in the direction is of teenagers and of families and parents. So I do parenting work with parents of children of all ages. And then I work also directly with sort of middle school and high school students and young adults. The handout that I gave you basically follows the talk that we're going to do today, the discussion we're going to have. And I give it to you, as I said earlier today in my previous workshop, this way you don't have to write down everything that I say. It allows you to focus more on the discussion itself. But you can also take notes directly on there and let it relate to that which we're discussing. I think the best analogy that I've actually heard for this dynamic of the parent-child dialogue was actually something that that I heard given in the name of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in the late 19th century in Germany is most well known for his commentary on Tanakh. And on the Torah, really, even more than Tanakh. And in his discussion on the Chagim and on the holidays, what he did was he looked at the symbolism of different aspects of the Chagim in an attempt to understand their meaning. And when he looked specifically at Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot in Tishrei, he actually had a very interesting point about the phase of the moon. And he said as follows. If you look at the moon phase during Rosh Hashanah, it's basically empty. It's a new moon. What is the dynamic that goes on in Rosh Hashanah and following Rosh Hashanah and Aseret Yemei Teshuva? Is it's really our job as B'nai Yisrael to start doing some introspection and to start to think and to start to think about us in relationship to God. And says Hirsch, it's our job to move toward God. That's what Rosh Hashanah and Aseret Yemei Teshuva are about our own decision to start taking steps toward God. Come Yom Kippur, right? And we have 10 days in, so the moon has started to show itself. And the moon, representing, in this case, godliness, demonstrates that the dynamic in Yom Kippur is actually that God says, look, you've done a lot of work. You've done the job of starting to think and to reevaluate and to take steps toward me. I'm now ready to begin taking steps toward you. And Yom Kippur is about the two joining. There's more of a God presence, of a God approaching in Yom Kippur. Comes Sukkot, right? And it's a full moon, the 15th of the month. The full moon, God is presenting himself in all of his glory. It's him approaching us. That's the dynamic of the sukkah, right? We're in this hut that we are hoping God will protect us from the elements. At that point, come Pesukkot, God is approaching us. He's making the approach toward us. We've done our work. We're not done. We've done our work. Hashem says, now I am going to approach you. I'm coming toward you. We know that this dynamic of parent-child is repeated throughout. The analogy is throughout Tanakh, throughout Jewish philosophy. But especially, you look especially around Pesach time, that God birthed us as a nation, so to speak, right? Our relationship to God is that of a parent-child. God is our parent, and we are his children. That is the dynamic that I take in discussing with parents about how to join your child. If you want to join your child, your job is to be in the full moon phase. It's mostly on you. In the full moon, God is approaching his children, and if you want to join and find some way of communicating and dialoguing with your child, you're going to have to do most of the work. And if a parent comes in having had a very difficult relationship with their child, with their teen, and is angry at their teen, then they're going to have a much bigger struggle in what we're about to talk about than the parent who has that stronger relationship, who feels better about their child. How do you have a feel good about your child? That was the last talk. But what we're talking about here is how to dialogue, how to join, how to get your child to connect with you. Okay. So let's look at that first page. And what we're going to really do is categorize this into two pieces. Number one is the concept of valuing your teen and finding some way to demonstrate that you're, to your teenager that you value him or her. And somebody asked me before before I began if this also pertains to kids post-teen. So the simple answer is yes, it absolutely is post-teen, young adult. The more complex answer is that what we're finding is psychologically in the research, there's this new area of focus now in the post-adolescent. It's called late. They've given it lots of different labels, but that this idea that adolescence or teenagerdom doesn't end at 19 years old. In fact, it continues because it's the dynamics of the teenage phase of those things that are important to them and the way that they think that continue for many, many years in terms of identity development and values and what's important to them. So, but when we're talking, we'll call it teens. But in order to successfully dialogue with your teen, there's two things that you need to do. Number one is you need to demonstrate to your teen that you value him or her. Once you've demonstrated that you value him or her, you then have to find a way sort of tachlis of joining him or her. Finding some way in joining them, and that's that moon analogy of moving forward and stepping up to whatever it is that interests your child. We'll talk about those, both of those halves. Valuing your teen requires that you understand your teen. Demonstrating to your teenager that you think they're valuable, that they have something to contribute, that they are not worthless, right, requires that you first understand what's important to them. And so we've developed, what I presented here is four areas of adolescent dynamics. Very briefly, we're going to go through them. This is not a psych class, so we're not going to go through it that deeply. But what we want to do is understand that these four dynamics are common to all teenagers. This is what they're going through. This is who they are as people. And if we can understand these dynamics and ultimately reinforce the positive dynamics, then they start to feel good about themselves and ultimately feel good about us. And that increases the communication. So let's take a look. Number one is self-perception. I said a moment ago, identity development. Teenagers are developing their identity. Who am I? As those of you who heard me earlier this morning, that accounts for that shift of where our kids think we are the end-all and be-all and we're the best things out there and, you know, we have all the answers. That shift towards my friends are much more important to me. The example I gave this morning was the class clown, right? Is that kid, that dynamic of the kid who makes jokes in the middle of class despite the teacher yelling at him or her, despite the teacher sending them out of the room, that child is valuing the opinion of the teen, of his peers, much more than he's valuing the opinion of his teacher. So we'll see that more in a moment, but part of what that is about is figuring out who am I? Who am I as a person? What are my values? Am I valuable? Am I good or am I bad? These are the simple questions that they ask themselves. So they're trying to figure out who they are, and this identity can develop into positive or negative self-esteem. Right? They can ultimately feel good about themselves, or they can feel pretty badly about themselves. Thinking styles. So self-perception. Thinking about themselves is something that all teens do. They think about themselves. Number two is thinking style. The thinking styles that characterize these age kids is very complex because what they do is they shift back and forth. So one minute you're talking to your teenager like a young adult, and you're having this fantastic conversation. And all of a sudden, they're being totally irrational and being childish. Right? You'll tell them, you'll have this great conversation about what they're learning, or about what's going on with their friends that they're concerned about. Right? You're having this great conversation. And then you say, all right, go set the table for dinner. Nah, I don't want to go do that. I'm going to go do something else. Right? So what happens is they keep switching back and forth between the subjective, egocentric, everything is about me, to the ability to think more objectively, to be able to understand other people's perspectives. And they shift, and it throws us for a loop. It's very difficult. But the concept is that this thinking style is happening, this back and forth. Black and white thinking is very simplistic black. It's good or it's bad. And young kids are all about good or bad, right? Older kids, our teenagers, are often, again, they shift back and forth, able to consider those shades of gray, the nuances. Well, in one case, this would be appropriate, but in another case, it's not so appropriate. So, but they do have this tendency to go back to the black and white thinking, which is not helpful thinking. It's very simplistic thinking. Yes, you had a question.
At some point, maybe you could leave in how we have impact on their self-esteem.
I'm going to get to that. Good. Yes, she asked me to weave in the impact that parents have on self-esteem, and we'll get there. And then, of course, we said the preoccupation with the opinion of others. That's a thread that really follows through all of these. So they have this unique thinking style, unique to them, outside of any other age. Okay? So they have this dynamic of self-perception, right, of how I think about myself, how I think and consider the world around me. Defense mechanisms. Here's the deal. Kids are incredible at defense mechanisms. Defense mechanisms are these ways that we make ourselves feel better. I don't like being upset, anxious, guilty, feeling guilty. And so what I do is I develop all of these ways of pushing away that guilt, of pushing away that feeling of anxiety, of upset. And kids, teenagers, are amazing at this. Right? You say to your teen, the teenager comes home, you got a note from school because they cheated on a test. How could you cheat on a test? Well, the teacher never taught us that. It wasn't fair. The teacher gave us a test on stuff they never taught us. Right? You cheated on a test. You're in trouble for cheating on a test. You should feel badly you cheated on a test, but they don't want to feel bad. So they come up with this rationalization. Right? Everybody, the teacher was unfair. So if the teacher was unfair, it was okay, therefore, to cheat. They're really good at using these. Denial. You really hurt so-and-so. Nah, it wasn't so bad. I just tapped them. It was really no big deal. Right? That's reducing that feeling of guilt. The problem with using a defense mechanism is that they don't address the issue. It allows them to shy away from whatever's going on. The kid cheated on the test because they didn't study. So they're not getting to address that issue if they get to successfully use the defense mechanism. The point is that they use them, and they're really good at it, and we have to understand that that is something that teenagers do. The last piece is their values. Values for teens become part of this identity formation. Parent teacher approval is a way that they develop their values. First, what do my parents and teachers like? Value. And then what do my peers value? And that becomes part of their value system. They are passionate, as we said earlier today in my previous talk, they are passionate about fairness and justice. That's a value that's incredibly important. So we have these four dynamics that we now have to know. I'll keep in mind, be ready to spit back at a moment's notice. Right? These are four dynamics that these adolescents have. Knowing that, the question becomes, now how do I show them that I value them? And that's the bottom slide. You demonstrate value. You demonstrate that you value your child by doing things that encourage the positive expression of these dynamics. You interact with them in a way that encourages the positive expressions of these, because as soon as they get to demonstrate and feel the positive expressions of these, they feel good about themselves. And when they feel good about themselves, they feel good about you, and they're much more open to the dynamic, to the dialogue. Positive self-esteem. You want to encourage positive self-esteem. You want to encourage the objective, mature thinking and get them to shy away from the black and white and subjective thinking. You want to encourage them to use their defense mechanisms as infrequently as possible. Don't forget, if in your children's interactions with you, they don't have to use defense mechanisms, then that says something about your relationship with them. If you and your child can have a discussion about what went wrong and what needs to change, and they can discuss that with you, we'll talk about how in a minute, then that says something to your ability to dialogue with them. And that's very, very important. And then you want to help them to internalize the values of fairness, justice, honesty, loyalty, and caring. If you could do these things, you're set. You've showed your child you value them, you're good to go, and now they're going to be much more open and relaxed with you. So the question becomes, how do we do that? What we're going to look at is a couple of different behavioral changes that you can do with your children. Now, some of you are going to say, I do 1 and 2, but I don't do 4 and 5. I do 3 and 4, and I don't do number 2. The question is finding yourself on these charts, on these slides. But the point is that these, what we're going to look at now, are some very concrete ways to enhance the positive expression. And as you enhance the positive expression of those needs, they feel better about themselves. And if they feel better about themselves, they value you for helping them to feel better about themselves. So let's look at it. Communication. Directly communicate instructions, boundaries, and expectations. Use specific language to express the needs, expectations, and behaviors. The more directly that you can communicate with them, the more clear your language is when you set your rules and expectations, the less ambiguity there is. The less ambiguity there is, the more they're able to do what they're being asked to do and live up to your expectations. Okay? For instance, one of the things I hear all the time is I'd really like it if you'd set the table. To which the child says, okay, glad to hear it. I'm going to read a book. And disappears. Then the child says, I told you I need you to set the table. No, you didn't. All you said was that you would make you happy. I wasn't in the mood to make you happy right now. clean your room. Clean your room before you go to sleep. So the kid makes their bed. Doesn't put their clothes away. I told you to clean your room. My room is clean. The clothes are in a pile in the corner of the room. The child needs the clear expectation from you using clear language about what you want. The more clear you can be, the more your child's going to be able to keep up with what you're asking. It's very, very important. I do this with teachers as well. Any of you who are educators, in classrooms, I develop with teachers a set of policies that are very clear and specific. Because kids need the predictability and they need the clarity. And it helps them. Because it helps them to know what they're expected, what's expected of them. Mutual respect. We can expect our children to act respectfully of us. Children have to act respectfully. They're not allowed to come up and curse at us. They're not allowed to come up and hit us. The question is, can we expect kids to respect us? Can we expect them to feel good about us? That's not so clear. In fact, I would argue that you need to earn the respect of your child. And if you earn one of the ways we earn the respect, that they think of us in a respectful way, not just that they act respectfully, but that they respect us for who we are, the way that we do that is by showing them that we respect them. And that goes back to respecting their values and respecting who they are as people. So respect is through fair treatment and dignity. We don't embarrass our children. And we do our best to treat them fairly. Now, the earlier session was all about that one line, how to treat our kids fairly. Okay? But what it comes down to is it's connected directly to the communication, is that your expectations are done in a way that the kids understand them and they understand what the consequences of that. And if you continue and consistently treat them fairly, then they feel like, yeah, okay, what's happening makes sense. The way my parent is talking to me makes sense. It's fair. And they feel that that's respect. Mutual respect increases motivation and appropriate behavior. When your kid respects you, then they want to do well for you. I just came back from Detroit, where I gave a talk to a high school about cheating. There was cheating going on in the high school a lot. And we did a workshop, a whole morning workshop. It took half a day. And the upshot of the workshop, they had asked me to come in and talk about how to stop cheating in the school. The upshot of the workshop was not about, well, give two versions of the test or seat the kids in different ways. And I said, they can come up with that. What we talked about was increasing the feelings of respect in the classroom. Because if the children feel respect toward the teacher or toward the parent, then they're invested in that relationship and they don't want to cheat. It's the same thing that happens at home. If we treat them with respect and aren't flying off the handle and are very clear with what we're telling them, then they feel respected. They feel respected by us. And they feel respected and they feel like you're treating them fairly and they therefore are invested in the relationship with you. What all of this leads to is number three. Number three and number four go together as well, this empowerment and this encouragement. You want to demonstrate to your teen that he or she has the ability to make a difference. Teach that privilege comes with responsibility. You would like to stay up later because you're older. You have to make sure that you're up for school in the morning. You're teaching them. Now, what you do when they don't get up in the morning is also another discussion. But what you start to teach them is that they have control over their lives. I have parents that come in all the time and say, my child won't do his homework. My high school student won't do his homework. And I go in there and I say, did you study yet? Have you done your work? Have you done your homework? And he just says, oh yeah, I'm doing it, or get out of my room. What we want to shift that to is, do your homework, and it depends on the age, but it can be, do your homework, your teacher's going to give you a grade based on your homework. I'm not going to bug you about it. It's you taking the responsibility. Or, do your homework. I need to see it when it's done. Not, I'm going to stand over you and do it with you. Or I'm going to keep bugging you, have you done it? But it's this idea of teaching them that the privilege of adolescence comes with responsibility. Because what that teaches is that they are masters of their own lives. They're masters of their own future. And that's very important. Go back to that self-identity. They need to feel good about themselves. The way they feel good about themselves is when they feel in control. And they feel in control when we give them control. And they appreciate that and they need that. You have a question? It all depends. I gave two different examples there for a very specific reason. Because it all depends on what the situation is and where the kid is at. I am an advocate in general for making homework between the child and the school. Not between the child and the parent, in general. But that's not always an easy thing, and it depends on the situation. The other piece, and this is very important, this is subtle, is number four, is encouragement. Parents are natural problem solvers. When our kid comes to us with a problem, we want to fix it. Whether they're real young and they can't zip up their jacket, or when they're older and they haven't finished the report and it's due tomorrow. We want to fix it for them. And that's because we're wonderful people. That's because we love them. And we're natural problem solvers. The problem is that when we solve it for them, it robs them of the opportunity to take control and to take ownership. And so they don't get to feel in control of their lives. They don't get to feel like masters of their future. That robs them of the opportunity to have positive self-esteem, to think creatively. And so it's very hard, because especially when we see our child in pain, we don't want to leave them like that. But one of the most important things we can do to our child is encourage them to take the responsibility. So that doesn't mean that your child comes to you the night before a paper is due and says, I don't know what I'm going to do, and is ripping their hair out, and you say, good luck. Right? We're not going that far. But what we're saying is, your paper's due tomorrow, you don't have it yet, what can you do? I don't know, I can't think, I'm gonna get in trouble. But what are your options? And you get them to sort of pull out some, that might work. Maybe if I email my teacher and tell them that I'm not going to have it in, then at least it's better than walking into class and say, I don't have my homework. Okay. Maybe if I tell my teacher that I'm going to say, in 2 days I'll have it, I need a 2-day extension. then it's different. Maybe I'll stay up all... Dad, if you can look up the stuff on the internet, then I'll take it and I'll put it in... Interesting. Right? The idea here is you're getting them to solve for themselves. And believe it or not, this ties back into this topic of dialoguing with your teenager. Because you're giving them the opportunity to feel good about themselves. And that's crucial. It's crucial to how they feel about you, because you're giving this to them. So the empowerment is teaching them that responsibility comes with privilege, and the encouragement is trying to get them to problem solve on their own. Number five is probably the most important. And I'm sure you've heard this in a million different Musar Shmuzes, but it remains, and I think that it's very hard for us to keep this in mind all the time, is that kids learn from us whether we want them to or not. And when our kid does something and we turn around and we snap at them, or we do something, you know, I had somebody come into my office who said that we were talking about this kind of stuff, and they said, yeah, you know, mea culpa, I did something the other day. What was it? We went to a movie, and I didn't want them to buy, you know, any of the chocolate in the movie theater, the Twizzlers in the movie theater, so we brought our own. And I told my kid, shh, you know, we'll bring the food in, it's fine, we'll eat it at our seat, right? So the parent felt really bad, because what they did was they modeled for their child that it was okay to bring in your own food when the theater has a sign that says no outside food or drink, right? We model for our children, they learn from us. And they learn their values from us. So if this teen, go back to our adolescent dynamics, if our teenager is developing the sense of values and is developing the sense of what's right and wrong and how they feel about justice and fairness, and we model for them justice and fairness, why'd you do that? I don't want to hear it anymore. Just go to your room. Right? That's not modeling fairness and justice. We say, okay, let me hear it. Okay, good. Now go to your room. Right? But we listen to them. That models for them something. That models for them a value that they are looking to try to figure out to begin with. So, what are these doing? What these five things are doing is relating back to the dynamics, which in turn relate back to the opening slide. If you want your child to talk to you, you want your child to be willing to listen to you when you have direction, but then to talk to you when they have a question, they have to feel comfortable with you. How do you get them to feel comfortable with you? By behaving in a way with them that's important to them. This is where you're stepping towards them. So, what's important to them is to feel good about themselves. You give them opportunities to feel good about themselves. What's important to them is to have mature, sophisticated thinking that makes them feel more in control and more able. How do we do that? By forcing them to come up with their own solutions. We guide them, but we force them to come up with their own solutions. How do we demonstrate that justice and fairness is an important value for them? By acting it ourselves. So we're doing all of those things. And you have to find ways to do that. I think that the most common and frequent opportunity for that is in our limit setting with them. I think that anything that you decide is a rule for your child, you can encompass all five of these things with those rules. Coming up with what the expectation is, that is a fair expectation, is one, feeds into this. Letting them know what the expectation is in a way that's clear and not ambiguous fits into this. Developing the consequence, where you pose what the consequence is, but then be open to having a discussion about it. So you say, you have to be in bed, lights out are at 11 o'clock at night. Okay? And you have to be up at 6 for school. The bus comes at 7, you got to be up at 6. And your child, why? Because, right? You have to get enough sleep. And by getting up at 6, you're showing me that you're okay, that this is enough sleep. That's all fair. Now your child turns around and says, that's too early, I don't have to get up at 6. when you turn around and say to them, well, tell me why, make your argument, and you entertain their argument, then you're modeling fairness. You're also forcing them, okay, so you're saying that you don't have to get up at 6. You can get up at 6:20 and be out the door. You have two choices at that point, right? You as a parent could say, and if you're not out the door, then you are getting up at 6 tomorrow. Or you can say, well, what happens if you don't get out the door by 7 o'clock? What do we do then? And that goes back to encouraging them. So every one of these slides can relate to any number of interactions you have with your child. But setting that limit with them is a wonderful way to incorporate all of it. And what it all ends up doing is really making them feel very good about themselves, because it gives them that real sense of control. And they feel much more comfortable with you as parents. That's part one. And that's the meat of it. Part two is sharing their interest. And in many ways, this can be the hard part. It's trying to find a way of sharing what your child is interested in. Is not always easy. Now that you've made your teen feel valued and valuable, we have to find opportunities to join them. Maybe you're not into skydiving, so forget that picture. You're looking for three ways of sharing their interests. Okay? You're looking for shared language. So any of you who have kids with cell phones, and you can understand the text messaging language, there's all these abbreviations for text messages when they're sending messages to each other. Okay? That's a shared language. If you know. It's also really good to know what they're saying, because they say stuff that there's an abbreviation for "my parent is coming, so I'm going to stop texting now." There's all sorts of abbreviations. You're looking for shared language. You're looking for shared experience, things that you can do together, and common interests, things that you hold in common. And in many ways, it's incredibly difficult to do that. I think a good example is this probably about 6 months ago, I had a mother and daughter in my office. The daughter was, I think, in eighth grade at the time, eighth or ninth grade. And they had a very, very difficult relationship. They were not getting along, and everything the mother asked her to do, she wouldn't do, and she wasn't interested. And the mother said, "All right, I'm ready to try something new. I want to join this kid. I'm gonna do something. Whatever the child wants to do, I'm gonna do." So she comes back the next week, the mother alone, and she says to me, "It didn't work so well. What happened?" I said to my child, "What do you want to do?" And my daughter said, "Nothing." I said, no, come on, let's go do something." She said, "I don't want to do anything. It's Sunday, there's no school today, let's go out. Hey, do you want to go ice skating?" And the daughter said, mm-mm. Then the mother's thinking about it. "Do you want to go," what was the example she gave me? "Do you want to go out and get some ice cream?" The daughter said, "Okay, yeah, let's go." The mother's so excited because now they're going to do something, they're going to join. She gets to the ice cream shop, and the daughter goes, "I don't want ice cream anymore. Okay? Well, now she's feeling exasperated. Now she's like, "Come on, I tried. I gave you ideas, and you're just not interested. What do you want to do?" "I want to go home and read a book, I think." And the mother's like, "But there's no interaction there." And so she felt understandably exhausted, upset, rejected, right? So I said to her, "Well, what's your daughter reading?" "I don't know." "What if you sat next to her in the room and read the same book?" "But then we're not interacting." And I understood what she was saying. But sometimes that is what that approach is all about, of us approaching our children. It's about accepting what they want to do in a way that's entirely unselfish. Right? It's doing what they want to do because they want to do it. It's joining them in what they want at the time that they're ready to do it. The great thing that she found is that when she read the book, you can guess what happened. Right? They were able to talk about the book. Sometimes the daughter didn't want to talk about the book with her. but they were off that Shabbos. They're doing something. They were walking together to Shul, and they saw something. And the mother actually said, you know, I made a comment about how that something, the tree or whatever, related to the tree in the book. And they had a little conversation. It wasn't like they solved all their problems. But there was some relationship. So the joining is figuring out when your child is willing to be joined, but joining them in what interests them. You have to approach them. You can't expect them to do what you want to do. Okay? So what I've done when I've given this talk before is we can go in two different directions. Sometimes, for the last 10 minutes or so, some people have examples of their own successes or challenges with their kids and trying to join and make that dialogue. What happens is, to take it back for a second, what happens is that when you've joined your child, and when your child has seen that not only do you value them, but you value what they do, then there is, believe it or not, this opening of the doors of conversation. On one level, it's that girl with her daughter. She has the book to talk about. Right? I can talk about something that we read together. But what it also allows is a more open back and forth of conversation. Because there's a feeling of, hey, they'll never think of you. You don't want them to think of you as their friend. Hey, we often, very often hear, say, I'm your parent, not your friend, or I'm your friend, not your parent. You don't want them to think of you as a friend. Because friends, they make fun of. Friends, they sort of josh each other. You don't want them to be your friend. And friends, they say no to. Right? When your friend asks you to do something, you often say no to your friend. You don't want them to think of you as a friend. But you want them to think of you as a parent who values them. Who values what they do. Because that will, there's almost a, I tell you, there's a switch that turns. That makes them much more comfortable sharing conversation with. So what I have on the back page are a couple of examples. Actually, some of these came up in conversations that I've had with people. And I think that actually I'd like to look at the bottom one, because the bottom one on that last page actually mixes together both sort of limit setting, but also joining. So somebody in the audience once raised their hand and said to me, every time I try to talk to my child about his or her friends, this was a girl. She answers my first question or two and then says, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I apologize. Let's start with number one. I asked my daughter about school. She went straight up to her room, answering me with a mumbled nothing on her way. What should I do? That's what it was. That was the example. So the girl walks in the door. How was school? Right? What happened at school? Nothing. Which is typical. Any of you with teenagers. You know, at least at some point. Teenagers don't really have much to share. And went to her room and closed the door. So the parents said to me, what am I supposed to do? And the truth is that this is this example of a real mix. On the one hand, I guess the line that I often tell parents is, what's the difference between what's normal and what's acceptable? Okay? What behavior is normal? And then at what point does it cross the line of acceptable? What's normal is that teenagers don't want to share with their parents that much. That's normal. They want to be with their friends. That's normal. And if we understand it as normal, it allows us to take it less personally when they don't want to talk to us. And that's very important. On the other hand, is it acceptable for your kid to say nothing and to ignore you and to walk up to their room? Probably not. So that's a place where you have to decide where you want to set that line. And what we talked about, what I've talked to parents about, is being able to say, you're not allowed to say nothing. You got to tell me something. Right? You've got to say, hi, how are you? The day was okay. Nothing much happened. Something. You've got to stop, look at me, and say something. Then you can go up to your room. What if she doesn't? If she doesn't, then we come back to this morning's talk, which is ahead of time setting up what that expectation and what that consequence is. And that there's some give and take in a parent-child relationship when you live in a house. And if kids don't do A, B, and C, then you won't be doing A, B, and C for them either. But the idea is mixing it up, but understanding, but not taking it personally. It allows us to interact with them in a much calmer way when we don't take personally what they're doing. Yes?
Me maybe though the parent has to also get feedback and say, well, when the kid walks into the house, up the bus, whatever, that isn't the best time to ask that question. Maybe sitting down at dinner, you know, maybe kids just like adults and then have to just wind down from when they get home.
Good. Did anybody hear that? Perhaps the parent needs feedback. Now is not the time to ask your child, to expect your child to talk to you. She just came in from school. She's been in school till 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon. She comes home off of the bus, which took a circuitous route. And I grew up in Los Angeles. We all drove, right? We had, I take buses to school. This idea of taking buses. The kid, you're on a bus for 45 minutes. But they're exhausted when they get home. So maybe that's not the time. And the ability to stop as a parent and say, my child needs her space right now, but that doesn't absolve them of being respectful when they walk in the house. And that's the respectful behavior. But when you say, hey, you know what? I think you come back at dinner time and say, you were probably really tired today when you come home. I'm not going to bug you when you come in the door anymore, but I want to hear about something later. That's giving them that respect. Any parent who can turn around to your child later and say, I made a mistake, or I shouldn't have done that, you earn lots of brownie points with your kids. Because they're so used to us, especially teachers, but they're so used to us saying, this is the rule, and by virtue of my saying it, that makes it right. And the moment that we can turn around and say, you know what, I thought about it, and I'm not so sure, is an incredible message to give to our children. My son doesn't want to come to Minyan with me. Can I demand that he do it? And should I? Demand. Now, we get into concepts, issues of davening and forcing and religious coercion. And I don't want to go there right now because it's very specific to family, to community. I mean, it's a very touchy issue and it's very specific. What I want to get at is what we were talking about, how you... why you want your child to come to Minyan, and do they have to come with you? If you want your child, this is for either one, if you want your child to come to shul, and it's a value in your house, then that's a value that you want to put out there. Many people say they want their child sitting next to them in shul because it's a shared experience. But if that's why you're doing it, to have a shared experience with your child, and your child's not interested, then you're shutting them down. Then it's not going to work to be the joint experience that you're asking them to be, that you want it to be. Part of joining them is figuring out what they want versus what you want. Now, I've had parents where I said, is it okay if your child goes to the teen Minyan or goes to a different Minyan that starts earlier but goes faster? Well, some parents will say, yes, it's okay if they do that because my value is them getting to shul. Some parents say no because I want to see my kid davening and I want them to be a part of this and to be with me. That brings us back to that issue of how are they presenting this to their child? What's your motivation? And if your motivation is joining them, then Minyan can be a joining activity or it can be a distancing activity. Sure, any of these things. So again, to look at this, the goal here is to make your kids feel good about you. That's your goal. Do they have to, or do we have to work so hard to make sure that our kids feel good about us? Yes. Yes, we do. We do. If our goal is to have kids that not only listen to us, but want to be connected to us. And that's what this is about. How do I get my child to want to connect with me? And the way that you do it is by making them feel good about you. And the way they feel good about you is when they know that you feel good about them. And these are the ways that you can do it. So to go back to that first slide or to the second slide, it really is two different bubbles. It's valuing your team. Who are they? Getting them to feel good about themselves. Valuing them, demonstrating for them in a tachless, real way that they are valuable, that you think that they're great, that they have what to contribute. The other half of that, which then opens up the doors, that makes them feel comfortable with you. That makes them feel good about you. Now you have to open the door. The way to open the door to the dialogue is to find the physical opportunities to be sitting with them and to be sharing with them. And the reason that that is not something so obvious is the element of doing it on their terms, when they want to and what they want to do. And that's hard for us. It's hard for us if we don't share their interest. We have to force ourselves to do it. You put those two things together, and it is. It's that switch that happens, and you have kids that start to talk. They told me the time was about up. Are there any questions? Yes. In other words, he's distancing himself. And it sounds like he's doing it. What you're presenting as a kid is probably doing it both to be a daskinik, you know, but also there's a genuine piece here. He's the oldest in the family. And yeah, going to the park to play on the swings, you know, isn't something that he really wants to do. So the question becomes, is there a way to engage him? For instance, what do you want to do? What you do is you first set our expectation. Our expectation is we do things as a family. Sometimes we can divide up the family, perhaps. Right? Mom can do one thing, dad can do something else. But the family has to be together. Now, it's not fair for us to do things that the 3-year-old likes when the 13-year-old doesn't like it. All the time. So now you say, okay, I value what you're saying. What would you like to do? Let's problem solve it. And you force them to... You want to go to this roller coaster or whatever. Well, what's a 3-year-old going to do? It's not fair to do something. Ah, well, what if we go to this one that has kiddie coasters and adult... Ah, okay, now we're talking. So you want to engage them. He's got a valid argument. But it's within the context of the family still has to do stuff together. You can't go off and do stuff on your own.
Is that reasonable?
Depends how old your teen is. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But then it's your obligation, your incumbent upon you as parents to say, to give something that they're interested in doing. That's only fair. But absolutely. Yes?
How could you have a following situation? Kid comes home from school and describes something that's going on that's not, he's right, it's not fair. But it's a problem that's not really solvable. And you recognize and say, well, I understand that's a very bad thing. I'm going to do what I can to solve it. You realize it's really a fundamental world issue that goes on in school that you can't solve.
Okay. I just got to this.
Okay.
But before we do this, most things are not unsolvable. However, and again, you're not talking in specifics, so it's hard. The first thing that I urge parents to do, you know, the line I use is balancing empathy and expectation. We have to balance our empathy for our children with the expectation that they do what we need them to do. But inherent in that line is that the empathy comes first. Your primary goal is to empathize with them and to say, you're right. This is horrible. This is a terrible position to be in. I wouldn't want to be in this position. This is terrible. I don't know what we can do about it. And you can engage them in the conversation about it. Often, I think most things do have some solution, but often they don't. And when they don't, you're stuck because you don't have an answer. But then your greatest asset is in demonstrating to your child that you agree with them that this is terrible. Because then at least they feel comfortable with you. You're going to feel bad because you can't solve it for them. They're going to get angry because they don't have a solution. But you will have at least bridged the gap of connecting with them, and that they're going to value. All right, I now have my second notice, so we're going to call it quits. Thank you very much.